End of intermission. Part two.
It does beg the question, why the hell wouldn't you want the prominent drum fill version out there in the world? Ringo played this. Why would you bury it? It enhances the song in every way. This is supposed to be a driving R&B dynamic song. Why would you smother that?
So what takes its place?
The brass, basically.
The brass.
And then it's just like way in the background and it makes no sense musically. But that aside, John had been the first one to point this out during the Playboy interview where he's talking about the song, which, as an aside, I don't think he plays an instrument on this song. As I remember the research, there are two guitar parts on it, but I think George plays them both. It's not like there's a lead solo or anything in the song, but at the end, there's that little bit of a break. You can hear two different guitars at the same time. One's kind of picking notes and the other's just kind of chunk, 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 you know, chops. But anyway, apparently he's neither one. But again, it speaks to they're casting the songs during the Revolver sessions. Don't need me in this? Fine, no problem. Isn't it just Ringo and Paul on Good Day Sunshine, I think?
I don't know.
And certainly the Indian songs, there might be a little bit of harmony from Paul, maybe, and John on that. But if you weren't needed, you didn't automatically have all four guys on every song, you know? And certainly there's a case to be made of Paul not being on She Said, She Said, but that's for different reasons.
Right.
So anyway, we got to get you in my life. I already liked it when I heard Revolver, and then it becomes a single all over the radio in 76. And it's like, it's amazing. A 10-year-old song, how rock has changed in 10 years, still packs a punch, still sounds great. And then it got that Second Life, Earth, Wind, and Fire covered it. Paul's like, oh, okay. And he trots it out for his 79 tour. So it's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. I don't think I can add anything. The only thing you mentioned the first time the Beatles have gone here, certainly with brass it is, but it does feel similar to Drive My Car. It's that same sort of aiming at a soul vein.
100%.
And you didn't say it directly. You sort of said it in general. What an incredible vocal.
Oh, yes.
You try to sing this song. I can't do it.
No.
I can't cover the range that he covers here. What an incredible vocal.
And he has that tendency he lets loose in like the fade of the record, you know? And if you listen, you compare the mono to the stereo, it's two different takes. His ad-libbing at the end is different in the mono from the stereo one. So depending on what your currency was as a listener, you would have heard different things. It just seems like, again, I don't say this as a criticism of Paul, but he does seem to cast his performances. So here he is a R&B shouter on this one, as distinct from the Here, There, and Everywhere vocal or something else.
And I would just push back. I know you didn't mean this. He's not shouting. That's the beauty of it. He's singing.
No, that's the term, you know, a blue shouter, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
I'm not saying he's shouting. No,
okay.
Exactly. You know what shouting is? With all due respect, and I'm probably going to push back from the female listeners on this one. It became this sort of anthemic thing when Cyndi Lauper did Girls Just Want to Have Fun. She's a perfectly great singer. That song is shouting.
I don't know.
That's how I was heard it.
I don't listen to it much. Okay.
It just offended my ears. So there's that.
That's valid.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we're up to my gold. And for me, it's Tomorrow Never Knows.
Good.
So many things to say about it. And we probably will. But I mean, the foundation of it, I guess literally and figuratively, is the drum and bass groove. It was a great groove back then, and 50, 60 years later, it's still a great groove to listen to.
Absolutely.
Strip away all the tape loops and strip away the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's a great groove.
Absolutely. Unprecedented. And the thing is, it's so in view of years to come, it's so forward thinking.
Absolutely.
What sounds like that in 66?
Of course. Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the stunning part, this is the first song they record for the album.
Right out of the gate.
You would think this is the payoff we're going to get, but the first one.
Work your way to it, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And what's even more striking, and this is in the accounts that are on record, is that, yes, it's gleaned from The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary. He had just bought that book like days before, Indica. He went there looking for a book by Nietzsche, and ended up with that. And so a quick read, and he's taking lyrics verbatim out of that book. He wrote this song really fast. And it's like, okay, guys, I got the song. I want to work on this first. And boom. So you're talking about a very small window of time that they capture an energy and excitement on the part of the guy who wrote it. And then every one of them steps in, you know, what would that song be without, as you describe, the drum and bass foundation, the atmosphere brought in by George with the tambora. And then on top of that, it's Paul and his tape loops that gives it all the atmosphere. It's like he would say a year later for benefit of Mr. Kite, I want to smell the sawdust. So they do that thing with the Calliope organs and give it atmosphere. They're in completely uncharted waters here with how do we convey the LSD experience to the non-users in sound. And they had no idea whether this was going to work or not, but they're Beatles and they're George Martin produced. So anything they do is not going to be self-indulgent. It's going to be tight, focused, to the point, listener-friendly, all these things. So that's what you end up with, which is an incredibly tall order to convey in under 3 minutes.
Couldn't agree more. And I would want to add this, and if I've got my facts right, and one of the things you love about the Beatles, because they're curious about things, if you follow them, they'll introduce you to worlds you had no idea existed. Right. And to me, this is the prime example. And if I've got my facts right, so John says it's his Tibetan Book of the Dead period. So what does that mean? Here's what I understand it to mean. So the Tibetan Book of the Dead is how to ease a soul from death to reincarnation. And in essence, it's saying you have to let go.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the idea.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream.
Right. And so Timothy Leary takes that idea and ties it to the LSD experience that if you try to control your trip, it ends up being a train wreck. You have to let go.
Complete surrender, yeah.
I think that's fascinating that we've got a song that's got reincarnation as the foundation of it, sort of filtered through an LSD experience. That's great. That's really interesting. That adds so much more color. Listen to the color of your dreams. So much more color to this song when you know it's got all this stuff going on in the meaning of the song. Wonderful.
It is so unbelievably profound. Everything you said and the high degree of craftsmanship. And I know to some people, and John Lennon in particular, that's a dirty word because it diminishes inspiration and the aspect of art an artist brought to the table. But to build that song to the point, I'll play the game existence to the end of the beginning, and it becomes a circular mantra, if you will, as a song fades into the distance. And then it's funny, my perception of Tomorrow Never Knows, I'm going to piss on it for millions of people listening to this, but when I first heard the song and trying to wrap your head around it, that very last bit of the fast piano.
Right.
Reminded me of like an Old West Yosemite Sam Looney Tunes cartoon, that kind of honky tonk piano here.
It's saloon, like, saloon piano.
Yeah. And it's just like, what does that have to do with anything? But that was the visual I had. And I stopped trying to have that visual because it's like a pie in the face or something, something profound. It's like, no, get rid of that. So I like it as a touch, but I have to lose that perception of it to fully enjoy the song. I don't know where it's coming from because it comes after the whole circular thing we just described, but it's cool. I like it sonically. Do you have a different interpretation?
I never had an interpretation other than they're trying to poke the balloon of pomposity that we've got a big, heavy song here.
Which is what he said he did with the title, putting a Ringoism on it.
Right, which is terrific. It works. The void works well. This I like Tomorrow Never Knows better. But it's the same idea, or my interpretation is it's the same idea of the laugh after George's Within Without You.
Yes.
Just trying to like deflate maybe the highfalutin goal here.
It's the wink.
Yeah, there you go. It's the wink. I don't like it though. I'd like it as I would much prefer it just fade out. Uh-huh. With the idea of the reincarnation.
A day in a life chord?
Yeah, well, no, just the fade out. Just the fade out from the beginning and back to the end of the beginning. So I wish it wasn't there. It's one of the few choices that they make that I'm like, oh, it was better without it.
But see, your explanation makes it work. That the wink, the don't take us too seriously, folks.
No, I think in this case, it takes it sideways. No, it diminishes it. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for me. And by the way, I don't think the laugh after Within Without You works, because I think the laugh is kind of spooky as opposed to jovial or silly.
So you like the idea, not the execution.
Exactly.
Maybe if they'd used the laugh in the opening cut during Sgt. Pepper theme, you know, at the very beginning, there's that burst of laughter before the verse starts.
Maybe, maybe. Yeah.
That's more convincing.
Good that you connect those dots. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So to recap.
Yes.
Your bronze was?
You're There and Everywhere.
Right.
And my silver is Honor Rigby. And my gold is Tomorrow Never Knows.
Right.
And yours, to recap, is?
My bronze was I Want to Tell You.
Right.
My silver was?
Got to Get You Into My Life.
That's right. That's right. And my gold was Honor Rigby.
Okay. I wouldn't argue with any of them.
And Tomorrow Never Knows is like, but for that piano at the end, it would have been gold. No. No. You know, if you'd asked me tomorrow, maybe that would have superseded Honor Rigby. I don't know. Maybe to put it another way, Tomorrow Never Knows, I've always revered. Honor Rigby, I liked a lot longer than I revered it. It's like only in more recent years that I really come to recognize, my God, how powerful and stark and unsentimental this is. It took a while for me to get to the full depths of it. And therefore, maybe it's a little bit fresher to me.
Mm, good observation. Oh, another observation. I don't think it's an original thought about Revolver in general. This is a lot of dark subject matter.
An undercurrent of death.
Absolutely. I counted, actually. Of the 14 songs on the record, six of them directly reference death.
And it's implicit in other ones.
I would agree.
So you've read my book.
Oh, so you made it clear in your book. But there's a lot of darkness here for sure.
Yes. Yes. And again, it's so counter to what's a rock star, pop star in 1966. What should they be putting out in their product? There's so much depth, but there's also this sort of reflexive, if everyone's going yin, we're going to go yang, you know, which was the Beatle way anyway. So many observers have said, for all the perception of 67 being the summer of love, the real summer of love was in 66, and the media just missed it. Because by 67, it had turned dark, the underbelly had started to surface, and the scene that had once been, by the time the mainstream discovered it, it was ready, as George was defined in San Francisco that summer, where it's all junkies and Bowery bums walking around. The Beatles were absolutely tuned in to the early clues to the new direction, always.
Always. And actually, that's one of the things that makes that John Lennon quote so wonderful and colorful. He said the Beatles were in the crow's nest.
Oh, yes.
We were all in a ship in the 60s, our generation, and the Beatles have to be in the crow's nest. And I interpret that two different ways. Number one, they're up in the crow's nest, so they're more visible because they're sort of above the horizon.
As well as isolated.
That's a good way to look at it. So there's a third interpretation. I interpret it as they're above the horizon. It's easier to see them. We all see them because of mass media, but it also means maybe they can see a little further into the future. And your observation about isolated, that's pretty damn good. I don't know that they were isolated, but it's a damn good observation.
In the sense that past a certain point, their lives were not like everybody else's, not like their audiences. They were in a bubble necessarily because of the adverse effect of their fame and not being able to walk out. But they started out just like everybody else, being very much at one with their fandom and their community. And that was in Liverpool. That was all over after 62.
And Pete Shotton, I think, makes the point that one of the reasons John got so heavily into drugs is he couldn't be outdoors and experience life as you and I do because the fame had shut him in. And so because he's an adrenaline junkie or an excitement junkie, he has to find something else to excite him indoors, hidden away, and it happens to be drugs.
Right. That is exactly the point of the cost of their success.
Mm.
And Paul was the one who most of all got around and lived his life and stayed a fixture in London.
Incredible. Paul, you know, he drives his own car. And
he rides the bus to the Let It Be sessions.
All those little things that just keep him so grounded. Wow.
And you look at that. I love that shot. It was in the original Let It Be, and it's in Get Back too, of George arriving, the big floppy hat on, and parking his Mercedes, and, you know, just furtively glancing around and getting in the building as quick as he can. Yes. It's like a nice little snapshot of what their lives have become.
And John's in a limo because he doesn't get down to earth. Maybe not in that video clip.
No, but it's like a nice little metaphor. And then Paul just throws up the sidewalk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to move on?
I think it's ready to segue into the curve we're throwing everybody right now.
Yeah. We go from genius to, wait a minute, what the hell's going on?
Are you a defense financial manager looking to invest in your career? Attend PDI, the Professional Development Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, May 29th to 31st. PDI is the premier annual training event for the DFM community. Register today at PDI2024.org. Early bird rates end April 30th.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
So do you want to set it up?
Sure. Okay. So for the first time since 1962, that's when they're signed to EMI, put out in October their first single, record the second one, but don't put it out till early the next year. And from that point on, from 63, 64, 65, they're on this treadmill of two albums a year, whatever singles in between, but they absolutely positively must have an album out in spring. And for two of those years, they were soundtrack albums. And then they have to have a Christmas time release, even if they're not fully ready, as they weren't for Rubber Soul and arguably Beatles for Sale, where, you know, half the album is covers. And for Rubber Soul, they were scrambling to get that thing done and out by Christmas, including using a help left over just to fill up the track quota. 66, they're like, screw it. We're not even going to try. You know, we've all gone off taking our sabbaticals during the late summer. John's making his film. Paul's writing a film score. George is in India. Ringo is conceiving Jason. So they're all off doing something. And they convene, and they don't even have time to complete a single by year's end. They start Strawberry Fields, and that takes an ungodly amount of time. They could have composed or could have recorded three Please Please Me albums by the time they get that thing underway. And When I'm 64, and then Penny Lane gets started. So they're nowhere near in shape. EMI is panicked for their fourth quarter earnings. They need something from the Beatles. So fine. What do? They pull together something that the Beatles had been always averse to, which is a collection, a greatest hits. Now, a number of these had already escaped in foreign markets, but not in Britain. So everything about this release, a collection of Beatle oldies, screams complete lack of input from the Beatles. From the cover art to the title, arguably to the song selection, it's not intended to be comprehensive because it certainly is not. So it's not like a Past Masters. It's not like a Beatles Rarities. It's not trying to scoop up everything. So it doesn't have that. What does it have? Well, what it has is an odd sort of perception of greatest hits that mixes singles with album tracks. And for value to the British market, they throw in a track recorded the year before and released in America is recorded when they recorded Dizzy Miss Lizzy. And that's Bad Boy, another Larry Williams song. So that was an odd thing that had been common currency in the States since June of 65 with the Beatles 6 album. But now it was getting a British release for the first time, which is sort of a reverse where things were coming out in Britain before they got heard in the States, and sometimes American DJs would bring the British release over to have an exclusive. So here it's the opposite, and I don't know if it ever got played in Britain before the end of 66. I remember first becoming aware of this release through Illustrated Record and those, you know, full-page reproductions of cover art and thinking, boy, does this look dated. Boy, does this scream 66. The term they always use is Carnaby Street. You know, the style and the art and all that. That has nothing to do with the Beatles, especially coming off of Klaus Voormann's design for Revolver. You know, it's like the Mike Leander to their George Martin in terms of different way of approaching something.
Do you like that album cover, Revolver?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, do you? Okay.
Do you?
No.
Okay.
there's a starkness to it. There's an unkeptness to it. You know, the photographs and their hair sort of thing. It doesn't work for me. I do like what Klaus said about it, that he was trying to communicate how the music has changed. How do you take the audience from Help, if you will, into Revolver? And the common denominator is hair. You know, the Beatles were all, that was their brand.
Their defining characteristic, sure.
Was their hair. So use that to sort of ease the transition. So philosophically or kind of intellectually, oh, that's a cool idea. I like that idea, but I just don't happen to like the result.
Interesting. Now, you've seen the Robert Freeman design. I just wonder if that's more to your keeping in line with what you think would be appropriate packaging.
I have, and that doesn't work for me either.
A little too literal, that it's around Revolver?
It's too literal, and it's not visually pleasing. You know, it's all warped sort of thing without being interesting.
Yeah. Well, I rejected that flat out, and that was the last time you worked with them as far as that went.
Do you want to say why you like the cover?
Revolver?
Yeah.
So I do aesthetically like the Revolver cover for a number of reasons. Number one, I think it's really idiosyncratic. It's like so Klaus, and also I think informed by somebody who knew them intimately. Just the level of detail and the way that they're arranged. You know, Paul in profile set a little bit apart from the others who are staring right on. The collage is interesting as like a little encapsulation of who they were. To me, it's a more artistic way of expressing what they would do on Pepper of their new selves standing alongside the Madame Tussaud old selves. It's a contrast. And then another thing about it is just as the White Album has the most unadorned art ever for its outside presentation, you have this starkness, both enclosing music that is as diverse and all over the map as can be. So it's a contrast. It's not in a line. So I like that aspect. You know, it's black and white while the audio is just bursting with color. So there's that. Beyond that, I don't give it too much thought, only that I find it pleasing and fitting. It's not jarring or inappropriate. Something like Magical Mystery Tour, as an example, I always thought that was kind of cheesy looking.
Yeah, totally agree.
There's something they could have done better with that.
Totally agree.
But going back to oldies, it screams, we had nothing to do with this, folks.
Right.
But going back to Revolver, you've seen the Freeman?
Isn't the back cover, isn't that a Robert Freeman?
That's Whitaker.
Oh, that's Whitaker. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah. As is Oldies, the photos taken in Japan when they were on tour in June that year, where they're working on that joint painting. Now, that would have been something if they had, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. They gave it a name, but they each worked on a corner and it was all of one piece and sold at an auction. Something like, God, what was it called? Faces of a Woman or something like that. And supposedly that's what it was about, but it's an abstract thing. And what if they put that on the cover? You know, at least it was their own artwork.
Agreed. That makes more sense to me.
Yeah, because EMI wants to sell records. That's why. And for it, they put their bets on Carnaby Street rather than what the Beatles came up with. So, I mean, they could have put literally anything on that. Have you ever seen the Beatles in Italy?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay. So the Beatles played Italy in 65. And 5 years later, John's doing the Lennon Remembers interview, and they're talking about live recordings. And he goes, there's apparently a show in Italy that was released. He clearly knows of the album's existence, but not much else. So he assumes it was a live album they did. And in fact, what it was EMI in Italy threw together a collection of tracks that I guess they were playing on tour. I know it opens with Long Tall Sally, but put it out as like a thing that, funnily enough, I think the only other place it was released was in Israel. But it's just basically a compilation of Beatle tracks to 1965. But the original issue was a picture of them from the DC Coliseum show of 64.
Okay.
It's very black, and then the Beatles in color in the spotlight. But then when they reissued it in the 70s, from that session they did either late 64, early 65, I think probably late 64, the one that yielded the cover they used for Beatles 6, where it looks like they're all holding onto a microphone. I think people thought, and actually it's a knife, they're cutting a cake, which is cropped out of it. But for Beatles in Italy, it's the champagne sequence. You've seen that series of pictures?
Yep.
Which I thought was a little more fitting. But in any event, I thought the second cover of Beatles in Italy fit more than the Washington, D.C. show, which you can barely see because it's kind of small.
And now,
anyway, we're talking about Beatles oldies. They could have gone a million different ways to make it a more suitable and sellable cover. I think EMI's thinking was, let's do something hip and happening now, and therefore it instantly dates it.
I couldn't agree with you more. Did the Beatles refuse to give them a picture, or did EMI said, we want to use this cover, we don't want to use your picture?
I think they just did it without any input from the Beatles whatsoever, and Brian must have said, fine, do what you're going to do, because, yeah, I know we've given you Christmas product every year, but it's not going to happen this year.
It shows how, I guess in this case, misguided EMI is. There's nothing hipper than a picture of the Beatles.
Sure. Yeah, and more timeless, ultimately.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The visuals of the Beatles in late 66, where they're starting to grow the facial hair out.
Right, right.
But then you've got this grab bag of material. And as we said, it's not comprehensive. There's no Love Me Do. There's no Please Please Me on it. There's no B-sides on it. But it's just an oddball mix of singles. And it's got Yesterday, which wasn't a single in Britain, but it was an EP track. Michelle, Bad Boy, released only in the States. From their most recent release, it's got Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, plus Paperback Writer, but not Rain. It's got both the double A side of We Can Work It Out, Day Tripper. But the oldest track on here, I guess, is From Me to You.
Yeah. Not only is it an odd grab bag of song selections, the sequencing is bizarre. Of all the choices in the world, why would you put Michelle and Yesterday back to back?
Nah, I wouldn't have done that. But is that any more jarring than the stark, somber Eleanor Rigby followed by I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Yeah, it's so misguided. Everything about it just feels misguided.
And She Loves You opens. I could see that as like an opening salvo with that tom roll. It could be a last track too with that sixth chord at the end. And maybe you can open with I Want to Hold Your Hand, but we'd already done that in the States with Meet the Beatles. So I don't know. It's a curiosity for sure.
Yeah. So we're going to do our bronze, silver, and gold?
I think so. It's a way for us to comment on singles that weren't on albums at that time.
Yeah, this is another one of our dodges.
Exactly.
So for me, my bronze is I Feel Fine. The lyrics are a throwaway. There's that whole rings and things, which is neither of us find very appealing, or I don't find appealing. I enjoy the smooth transition between the bridge and the verses. I'm so glad. It's very smooth how it goes back.
That's my favorite part, I think, is both vocalists going full tilt. It sounds joyous and uplifting.
And seamless. It doesn't feel jarring to me. To me, that's the second best thing. The first best thing is Ringo's drumming. I'm not super smart about drumming, but it seems like he's doing kind of a Latin swing rhythm. And then again, I'm not good with my drumming jargon, but he kind of does a cymbal ride or rides the cymbal the whole way.
The cup of the cymbal, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the best part of that song is Ringo's drumming.
Now, let me ask you this, Mr. American Uh-oh. Beatle fan, Beatle 65.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
Dr. Beatles Cherry. Yeah. So, I don't know if we talked about this on the show before or not, but do you have a preference between the U.S. mixes and the British mixes?
I think I've become so ingrained with the British now because that's what I listen to. I didn't have an issue back in the day. A good song's a good song's a good song, and I probably didn't recognize the nuances of it.
Oh, it's quite stark. One is sounding like they're literally recorded in a cavern, and the other is just like, my God, the clarity.
Yes, but I'm listening to records on like a childish record player.
Close and play.
Exactly, or on AM radio, so the nuances aren't coming through to me.
Okay, interesting. Dave Dexter would disagree, but okay.
She said This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.com, online professional therapy. It's been sort of a subtext to this show for as long as it's been on. If the Beatles had an implicit message about anything, it was about pursuing the light and the healthy and the positive. The theme of Yellow Submarine was no random thing. It actually completely aligned with who they aspired to be and the ideals they projected. BetterHelp makes it so much easier than traditional in-person therapy to do this. Being within reach online through video, chats, and by phone. Accessible most everywhere in the world with professional licensed therapists. And as a listener to this podcast, you can get 10% off your first month of treatment by going to BetterHelp, that's help, not health, as in the song and the film, .com/SATB, S-A-T-B, to get 10% off your first month of treatment. Now back to the second half of my conversation.
For me, to circle back to the bit we had in the conversation about, do you prefer your first heard or a letter heard? This was one of the exceptions where the first heard for years and years was the Echo Laden one. And then it was like revelatory to me when I heard the British mixes, like, wow, this is what's happening here. And it made me much more impressed with the overall performance. Not that I disliked it before, but it almost sounded cheesy before. And now it's like, wow, you get an enhancement of them as musicians by hearing the unadorned version. So that's become my go-to, is the UK one.
Which song?
Of I Feel Fine.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were moving on to something else.
No. Because that's probably the most egregious difference in US versus UK mixes.
Okay. Is that your bronze, or you're just making an observation?
I'm just making an observation while we're talking about that song. And then, as we know, in Beatle world, there's like a million different variants of that song in terms of issues released. One being whispering heard at the beginning of it before the feedback, and other being extended fade out with the barking at the end. So it's like nobody has done yet a comprehensive one, start to finish, of putting them all in one spot, which would be interesting someday.
There's something for you to tackle.
Yeah, I know. Put that to the list.
So you've probably talked about it in your show in the past. You hate everything Dave Dexter did.
I understand why he did it. Job one was to sell records to the market that he understood. Granted, he didn't like the Beatles to begin with. His job was, how do I move product for capital for this act that's going to come and go, and no one's going to think of them a year or 2 years from now? I know there's a lot of people that hate on him. I think he just did what he was paid to do. As far as preference and mixes, I skew more toward the UK ones, but that's because I pretty much ditched the American releases once I picked up that blue box, and they were no longer my go-tos. To this day, I will tell you, the other day, locally, and here's a shout out to Bob Stroud, who's just announced his retirement. But he was a DJ for years and years, did a show called Rock and Roll Roots, and was very much a curator of music. He would call out details and history and context and all that stuff. Great guy, not your normal screaming DJ at all. He was the opposite, very low key. And he was doing a salute to Ringo for his birthday, and he played Boys. And it's like, shit, Bob, why are you playing this version? It was the stereo mix with the vocals out one side. Like, there is an instance, go with the mono. That has nothing to do with Dave Dexter. That's a stereo versus mono discussion. But for the most part, I skew toward the British with certain caveats where it's clear that the mono may be preferable to the stereo. Not in every case. There's plenty of people like, well, the Beatles, they preferred the mono, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but you know what? There's instances where the mono clearly is not as good. Like that segue in the mono Pepper between Good Morning and Pepper Reprise, where it's a tighter edit in stereo. There's like an extra beat in the mono one, which makes it just less smooth. You know, and I can come up with all kinds of examples of things like that. Like George's guitar solo in Savoy Truffle in mono is just sloppier. It's just got noises in it and stuff. So anyway, things like that. It's case by case basis. And I would say the same with Dexter versus non-Dexter, but mostly I skew toward British.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So you're bronze.
My bronze would be Day Tripper, but that's a hard bronze. It's a strong one because that's a song that late in their career, showing what a really good, tight rock band they are before they got a lot more ambitious and spread out. I mean, they could always rock. You know, White Album was full of examples, and even Abbey Road. But something that's meant to be nothing more or less than a good sounding single.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, another riff song. And I think he said Pretty Woman was what informed him. And we did the show with Jack and Cameron recently where he points out the direct line in all these riff songs played in, I think, the key of E or whatever they're in, but a million different variants on that extending through Dig a Pony. You know, it's just something, if you're a guitarist, these are just little things you can spark off of and come up with original ways of doing something that's all sort of rooted in the same source. It's a riff song. It's a great performance. It's a great vocal. And I thought it was interesting to find out that John basically wrote the song, but Paul is sort of leading in the higher notes with the verses, which is cool.
Yeah.
So it makes it sound more like a group effort.
Yeah. And unusual that John wrote all is the singer you hear.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I love Ringo's drum rolls throughout it, the buildup vocally and guitar-wise in the break. So it's just tight, focused. And then there's the subject matter. You know, really ahead of the curve, the weekend hippie, what he was writing about, the person who lives a straight life until the weekend, and then they might be, whether it's acid or whatever else they're tripping off on, the weekend hippie. It's a nice bit of social commentary there, disguised as a rock song, right?
Right.
And she's a prick teaser. They change it to big teaser.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. Wouldn't have worked. Different females record it, like Nancy Sinatra. So prick teaser wouldn't have worked for her anyway. So there you go. It's a great, concise, we're going to write a single. And John fought for it to be the A-side, and that's when it became the first double A-side alongside We Can Work It Out.
Yeah. With Day Tripper, everything that you said, for me, this is one of the songs that's actually aged better as time has gone on. I think back in the day, it sort of felt like a throwaway single to me. And now I respect it and enjoy it a lot more, in large degree, because of Ringo's drumming.
Yeah, it's great. A song where, being self-deprecating, he often said, I can't even do a proper role. Although there's definitely examples all over the Beatles catalog where he does do roles. And the Tom roles are really tight and effective on this one, for sure.
Absolutely. And speaking of the Tom roles, I'll go to my silver.
Okay.
Which is She Loves You. And as you know, that song starts with Tom roles. And it's like the song tumbles into itself because of his drum lead in, it just sort of tumbles into the song. It's a great feel and a great sound. There's so many things to say about She Loves You. For me, so much energy packed into one song. It just explodes. The power of Paul's bass kind of rumbling through it under the yeah, yeah, yeahs. The harmony, I know, the corny ending that George Harrison came up with, according to George Martin, is a great touch. I don't know what you could say about the song that was a misfire. The lyrics are an interesting perspective.
Showing the consciously, let's depart from formula.
Yeah.
All our songs are full of pronouns to this point, but now let's do like a third person perspective.
Yeah. I mean, how clever is that? They're still relatively new at songwriting, but they're already figuring how to go different directions, different places.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I love about it, and it's something interesting, or it shows how good the hook was, you know, the falsetto thing in the song. They do it in the second and third verses. They don't do it in the first. And how your mind wants to fill in that ooh, that falsetto ooh in the first verse. That's how powerful that hook is in the song.
So do you remember when you first heard it? Would have been through the cartoon?
Probably.
You might have been then a little too young for the Sullivan Show, at least the first one.
I was too young, yeah.
Yeah, okay. How about the 65 show? You remember that at all?
I missed it. I don't think I was paying close attention for that.
Was the Sullivan Show a thing in your house?
No, it wasn't, which is maybe why I didn't see it.
Was Hollywood Palace on opposite that?
I have no idea.
I think that was Saturday nights, if I'm not mistaken, and Ed was Sunday nights, but it would make sense to run them head to head since they were sort of doing the same thing.
You didn't see either because you're too young, right?
I remember the final days of the Sullivan Show, but even then, I remember it wasn't like a regular thing in our house because it was perceived as so old school, puppets and plate spinners and all that stuff. Nobody gave a damn about that at that point. What's funny now is that I think for most people who think of Ed Sullivan, all you think about is the rock acts because that's gold.
Yeah.
And right up until the very end, you know, they're running Jackson 5 and all kinds of stuff like that. So that stuff, Andrew Salt has put together this wonderful line of thematic releases of all those performances. And it's funny that some are live, absolutely live. Some are lip synced, or at least a live vocal on top of the backing. and some are Fish Nor Fowl, that wonderful screw up by the Dave Clark Five where the tape doesn't start on time and they're standing there for what must seem an eternity on stage waiting for something to happen. It's just amazing. But when you look back at the 60s era of variety shows, what a richness there was in terms of all these rock performances that probably wouldn't have been preserved otherwise. Besides your Hollywood Palace, you also had Jonathan Winter's show and Smothers Brothers. It just seems like everybody who had a variety show would occasionally host a rock act, and it's cool to see this stuff now.
Yeah.
And it must be impossible to get all the clearances to comprehensively scoop all the stuff up, but great stuff. And occasionally you'll find lousy versions of it showing up on YouTube. It's great to have it.
Yeah. Just one comment about Ed Sullivan. I feel, but I'd have no factual basis for this, you may know, I feel like most of the performances were live and not lip-synced. Was there an 80-20 thing, lip-synced versus live? Do you know?
Past a certain point, like, I don't think it was uniform. There's a performance in quotes, Mamas and the Papas, and they're doing Creek Alley, and Cass is setting it up, and she's basically telling them it's the story of how we met and our prehistory and all that stuff. And as soon as she's done, she goes, roll tape.
Oh.
And then they clearly are lip-syncing it after that.
Okay.
And I know with the Stones, it seems like they were doing it live up at least through early 67, Let's Spend Some Time Together. And then the Doors seem to be, to borrow an album title, absolutely live when they did Light My Fire.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, but then there's certain things where it's absolutely clear, especially as stuff gets a lot more produced. You've got brass and strings and stuff like that. Even, I think, the 65 Beatles performance, yes, there are photos showing Paul doing Yesterday, and he's clearly not doing the record, just him, but they show the string players off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been established on good authority that that was canned and they were just props.
Right. It was pre-recorded, yeah.
Uh-huh. And I'm trying to think, I think the Doors, because I didn't come back to Sullivan Show, obviously, so it's a different thing. I'm trying to think if they were on Jonathan Winters or Smothers, whoever it was on, when they did Touch Me. And that was very clearly live vocal, but the record backing with the strings and the brass. But Curtis Amey on the sax solo at the end is clearly note for note the record. I know that the Stones appeared late on Sullivan 69. It seems like they did You Can't Always Get What You Want. Maybe I'm blending this with other TV shows they did in 69. I don't know. But I had the visual of them with Mick Taylor doing that. But as I think about it, maybe that was David Frost. And it was clearly lip-synced.
Okay.
Anyway. Somebody knows.
All right. So She Loves You, My Silver.
My Gold.
Ah.
And to build on everything we've said to this point, right now, it sounds like I'm just giving quantifiable reasons. But I guess the biggest, if I have to not speak of, well, it's the first single that they didn't rely on a harmonica hook. And it is such a major, major leap forward from the first three singles, Love Me Do, Please Please Me, From Me to You. It's like, where the hell did this come from? It's so beyond all of those. Yes, you got the pronouns still, but it's definitely more self-consciously clever in how they're being used. And there's no guitar break. There's no solo, which is interesting.
Yeah.
At the same time, there are fills that George does. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, so that's cool. He's got a presence and he's got that great Gretsch that you see in the visuals to the performances of this song. It sounds like a complete group performance. There's no dominating presence by any one or two Beatles. And then also the hi-hat that he does, wash of shh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great visual and just a great sonic aspect to it. So I love that. And it involves the really punchy kick. Boom, 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 boom. Driving the song along. The bass, as you say. And there's no real lead vocal. It's that third vocalist blend of John and Paul's voices with George occasionally chiming in. But it's got that great energy, great, great energy, great momentum to the last fading note on a vocal. You know, God, what genius arrangement for a pop song. Not a wasted note in it. It's so powerful, so compelling. And here in the Oldies Collection, they open the album with it. And in 1966, how quaint that must have sounded. How nostalgic. It's like, wow, you know. And when you think about what's going on in 66, Stones have just done Aftermath, which, if you're a Stones fan, it's heralded as, wow, their first album of all original material. And look, they've got an 11-minute song on this album. You know, good for them. They would do better. I would argue they did better with Satanic Majesties, but I'm not sure how many other people would make that case.
Not me.
Not you, but I quite like that album. I'm not diminishing it. I think the worst thing about it is the presentation. That looks foolish, but I think a lot of people critique it for the package more than they do the music that's within it. I mean, it's got She's a Rainbow on it. How can you diss that? And 2,000 Light Years from Home and 2,000 Man. But anyway, The Who have just done a quick one. Another early clue to the new direction. The little mini suite on there. I think Paul even told Townsend to his face that, yeah, that was an influence on Pepper in its way. Quick one being this powerhouse performance piece that they perfected in 2 years' time when they do it for Rock and Roll Circus. So much so, it's like, well, we're going to bury this for 40 years or 30 years, whatever it was. What else you got? The Kinks did Face to Face that year. Good Vibrations, Autumn of 66, Yardbirds, Happenings 10 Years Time Ago. Like the peak of creativity, I think, in that band with Page and Beck in the same band at the same time. All this great stuff, conspicuous by their absence in the wake of Revolver. Where are the Beatles? What are they up to? Instead, you get oldies. So it must have been a really bizarre thing to be a UK fan going into December 66. Really? This is what you're giving us?
I agree with what you're saying. The cover just...
Yeah. This is a joke, right?
It's a joke. Here's a bizarre observation. So one of the things we love about She Loves You is that it's someone telling someone else about someone else, right?
Yes.
So I'm sure you're familiar with, as I understand the story, when John is on his lost weekend, Paul spends some time with Yoko, and apparently they have the conversation, and Yoko says, if John wants me back, he's going to have to woo me back with flowers or whatever. So they're playing out She Loves You.
Yeah, great observation. Great tying that together.
That might be the biggest reach I've ever made, but
that's a good one.
But it's there. It's there. So they're seeing into their own future, Robert.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Talk about your early clues to the new direction.
Talk about a crow's nest.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So I think we're at my gold. Do you want to do your silver?
Let me think. Okay. So my bronze was Day Tripper, right?
Right. Yeah.
And your bronze was?
My bronze was I Feel Fine.
That's right. Okay. And then your silver was She Loves You.
Correct.
Which was my gold.
Right.
I see. Okay. I'll do my silver.
All right.
Bad Boy.
Whoa.
Right, just sitting down and look so good. He don't want to go to school and learn to read and write. Just sits around the house and plays that rock and roll music all night. Well, he puts some tacks on teacher's chair, puts your normal little girl hair. Now, Junior, behave yourself. Buy every rock and roll book magazine stand. Every dime that he gets, oh, is off to the jukebox man. Well, he worries his teeth until at night she's ready to poop. From rocking and a rolling, spinning in a hoo, a hoo. Well, this rock and roll has gotta stop. Junior's head is hot as rock. Now, Junior, behave yourself. Ow! Shop and get that haircut.
Sly Junior, behave yourself.
You don't like Bad Boy.
No, it's not that I don't.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Like it, it's just you've got so much sort of riches here, it's not one I would naturally go to.
But see, most of them are over familiar, and I'm trying to highlight the unsung. And some of these I've you know, I used Help on a previous show, I think. I can't remember if I used Can't Buy Me Love. I think I might have.
We're going to have a conversation about this, because I'm not sure that you should be highlighting songs, because I think this is your choice about what.
But my choices are the obscure. I look at this like, if I'm programming a playlist, that's what I'm going to pick. I'm not going to pick A Hard Day's Night.
Okay.
So this is what I would prefer to listen to right now if I have to walk around with this. Yes, Bad Boy. And the reason being, they were pretty done with the BBC by this time. I think the last BBC thing they did was the Beatles Invite You to Take a Ticket to Ride, and I think it was May of 65. And after that, because they were getting more demanding and the facilities they wanted to use, the music is getting more sophisticated. They were looking at the BBC setup as a little antiquated for their taste. How about we do it at EMI? BBC said no. And it was like, okay, well, I guess we're done here. And that was that. The point being, their BBC stuff, they were using it for two things, to promote their latest releases, but also it seems, as it abandoned the club sets by this time, to get some favorite tracks out of their system. Stuff they loved musically. Hey, let's play it for the BBC. Maybe turn some people onto it. So they're doing covers well through 63, 64. I'm not sure if there's, I think there's at least doing Matchbox and things like that. But so it's sort of an outlet for them to do their beloved rock and roll stuff. And now by 65, they're losing that platform. They're walking away from it. And so here you have, and yes, it would have been recorded, I guess, during the Help sessions alongside Dizzy Miss Lizzie. So it's late in the day, Beatles doing rock and roll. Both songs happen to be Larry Williams. Both happen to be John on vocal. But it's a nice little snapshot of same time they're crafting A Ticket to Ride or You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. This is where our hearts are at. This is what we really love. This is what gets our mojo going. And so it's this throwback 50s stuff. It underscores, even as the world of rock was evolving around them, and I'm talking pre-EMI, there's that whole first wave of rockers, the Elvis, Little Richard, Chuck Berry wave, Jerry Lee Lewis. And then by 1960, that scene is all dead. In some cases, literally, Eddie Cochran and Buddy. And Chuck Berry ends up in jail. Jerry Lee is disgraced. Elvis goes in the army, all that stuff. And rock changes. And suddenly it's taken over by the professionals, by the producers and the Brill Building songwriters, right? So it's no longer these independent auteurs writing and recording their own material. But the Beatles, during that period, as club acts pre-Brian, are still trotting that stuff out. They're still dressed in their leathers. So they're like these throwback to the first wave of rock and roll guys sort of evangelizing on behalf of, this is rock, folks. Never mind this Brill Building shit that, you know, is selling in the millions at that point. That's where their hearts were at. And so knowing that, here is like proof of that. As late as early 65, they're still going back to the Larry Williams and Carl Perkins, all these people that they still revered. They pretty much reached the point in their career by the end of 64 that we can't keep throwing covers into our releases. Not only are we such compulsive songwriters to this point, but that's really, we found our niche, we found our footing. This is what's going to sell. We have no interest in putting out a Carl Perkins cover as our next single. You know, that's not going to fly. But given the chance in the studio, hey, we got to fill up an album. Okay. Now, I'd seen some people writing, well, this was done strictly for the American market. I'm calling BS on that. No more than, you know, what was the excuse for Leave My Kitten Alone? They do a fantastic performance of that and then don't put it out. So to me, it's like a nice snapshot of who these guys were beneath the matching suits and the well-tailored, smoothed out live presentation and the Dick Lester films they were doing, that at heart, they're rockers. And I have no problem with Dizzy Miss Lizzy. I thought they did a fine take on that. And here's Bad Boy, which really struck a chord with me when I heard it as a kid getting into the Beatles, hearing it on the Beatles 6, like, wow, this is really cool. It's almost like a little character study that they didn't write, almost an aspect of Coasters to it. You know, that sort of visual goofing off in the classroom kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think Lennon's conviction in what he's singing takes it beyond novelty. It's not just, oh, how cute, they're doing Charlie Brown or whatever. No, it's like he's singing it like he means it and he loves it. So to me, it's got a great deal of value. Is it the greatest record that ever performs to everybody? No, of course not. But it's cool. It hits the bullseye. So that's what I have to say about it.
That's a good sell job.
Okay. Glad you approve.
And I would sort of echo the Lennon vocal. That's what makes this song. He's totally committed to it. There's nothing funny about it to him.
No.
He's full on. And he probably was. He's probably singing about himself. I mean, he probably was the right. Bad Boy. And actually, for me, not for fun, what do you like better, Dizzy Miss Lizzy or Bad Boy?
Bad Boy is more musically interesting because you've got the great drum fills from Ringo. You got the great lead guitar from George. Dizzy Miss Lizzy is kind of like a groove.
Yeah, and a repetitive groove. Yeah.
Yes. And he screws up the lead, but that's charming to me. And I like it tons better than Clapton's take at Toronto.
Okay.
Frankly, Dizzy Miss Lizzy. But, you know, Lennon was a different place then anyway.
Right.
But not to quantify, I like them both.
Gotcha. Okay.
Interesting that Dizzy Miss Lizzy is the one they trotted out for the 65 tour.
Yeah. I don't get it. All right. So I think we're up to my gold.
Yeah.
Which is A Hard Day's Night, because I didn't use it before. So here's my dodge.
Okay.
Just similar to She Loves You, just more propulsive energy. In this case, it's almost manic energy. It comes at you so fast.
Uh-huh.
It almost sounds double time. It's so fast. And then I know I spent a lot of time sort of talking about Ringo's bongos on You're Gonna Lose That Girl. They're interesting, but they feel sideways to the song.
Tacked on.
In this case, they feel like they're right in the song.
Fully integrated.
And it's machine gun. It's just machine gun bongos. You know, Paul's ability to sort of take it higher when he sings, When I'm Home, just how that ups the excitement. And then we get the cowbell. And of course, killer opening guitar, killer closing guitar. Not a riff necessarily.
Arpeggio.
Thank you. Great bookends on a great song.
Yeah. I can't disagree with any of that. It's a fantastic performance. Bigger than the sum of its parts. You know, it's not musically adventurous in composition, but it is an arrangement for sure, the way it was put together. You know, done overnight, I guess. You know, it's a piece of nothing lyrically, but there's something about the musical construction that gives it a depth and urgency that you get caught up in it, even if you're not understanding a single word of it, you know?
Yeah.
The turn of the phrase, A Hard Day's Night. Credited to Ringo. It's clever. It's a different use of words and all that stuff. So everything about it is so idiosyncratically Beatles. What a phenomenal use of the 12 string.
Mm.
Absent that, if Rickenbacker hadn't gifted them with that during the February visit, would that song exist in that form? I mean, that's to me is like the icing on the cake. That's what makes that song.
Mm-hmm. No argument for me. Yeah.
But it's spectacular. Me and Jerry Hammack had did that breakdown of them recording the solo at half speed, you know, and doubling it with piano. So it's got this great, there's sort of a dark undercurrent, not dark necessarily something morbid, but just dark in terms of color, like dark chocolate, you know, it's got an extra bit of flavor to it that's say absent from a She Loves You, which is all sunshine. And maybe there's a minor in there. So I haven't thought about it that deeply, but there's something about it. There's an undercurrent there.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I do sense that solo, I mean, it sounds really fast. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it was recorded at half speed and then put at regular speed. So there's something about it that doesn't sit well on my ear, but because it's just part of the energy, I don't care.
Uh-huh.
But there's something different that speaks to you in that solo. Is it the piano that deepens it?
I think so. The bass notes on the piano? Yeah. I think that's what it is.
Okay.
Because
okay.
that's not commonly the range of a piano you tend to hear on a pop record.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's very, very effective.
Agreed.
I thought it was hilarious the first time I heard the BBC take. There was that bootleg where they used the, they call it Top of the Pops, even though I think it's Saturday Club. And it was the Beatles promoting A Hard Day's Night on Brian Matthews' show. And they do A Hard Day's Night. And they get to the solo, and it's clearly the record chopped into it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Unmistakably.
That sounds like more work than actually just trying to play the solo.
Well, they hadn't gone on tour yet, and that's when he had to play it, you know? So then he had it mastered by then. And then Brian Matthews says something like that, because they do an extended fade on it, and he says, "We did that to prove we weren't playing the record."
Great.
Yeah.
All right, so let's review. My bronze was I Feel Fine. My silver was She Loves You. My gold is Hard Day's Night. Your bronze?
My bronze was Day Tripper.
Day Tripper.
My silver was Bad Boy. And my gold was She Loves You.
Okay, got it.
I can live with those choices.
Absolutely.
So, as we said, this discussion for the last half hour or so has been one big dodge to talk about these songs that weren't on albums mostly, and we hadn't covered them in the earlier Olympiads, and now we have. And plus, we got to diss this release quite a bit.
Which aren't we two-faced? We take advantage of it, and then we diss it at the same time.
I call it being clever, but yeah.
If that works for you, Robert.
It does. It's interesting that they went through the trouble in the CD era to put out at least two volumes before they brought it to a screeching halt of the Capitol releases on CD.
Okay.
But I never saw any sort of clamor, and Our Lives Aren't Over Yet, but they never put out Goalies just for the nostalgia in Britain on CD.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a market for it.
Probably. Yeah, sure.
Unless they just aren't as crass as we are in America.
What a letdown, though, to talk about all that's going on in Revolver and then to talk about this. Sorry, it's going backwards, which is your sort of, that's your whole point about this record. It feels like it's going backwards and the Beatles don't go backwards.
Such was the UK experience in 1966 with the Beatles.
There you go.
Uh-huh. Grander things on the horizon, as we know.
Yeah, exactly.
Picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came, Father Mackenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved, all the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, sponsored by BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/zappy for 10% off your first month. Executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
next few minutes are in the lap of the gods and the hands of the Beatles, which means anything can happen. We're going to hear sort of versions of songs from their film. Gather round, famous film stars.
Gather round.
Then.
Right.
Now, look, in my young days, when I was a lad, they used to have actors in films and that.
Yes.
Now they...
Hey, listen.
It's all changed now, all Brian. Changed,
well, this is what
they're
I wondered.
They're not doing that. No actors.
In those days, the actors used to say their best bits were left on the cutting room floor. Did you find that?
No. Those are the good bits in the film. You should have seen the rest.
Yes.
Rubbish.
Was it really?
Even worse, yes.
Who was worse?
Oh, Paul.
I see.
I think John was about the worst.
No, it was you.
Oh, Ringo was very good. He's a good lad, yes.
They're saying he's a new Charlie Chaplin. Do you think that's right?
He's an old one. Okay, Ring.
Beginning to look like it.
Now then.
Can you hear him?
Not really. I hope
not. We brought the flowers, Ring.
Not allowed to talk.
We brought you the flowers.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And the grapes.
Oh, I like grapes.
He likes grapes.
He likes,
you know.
Brian's nose is
peeling. My
nose
is peeling, yes.
Listeners.
Yes, been in the sun.
Been to Portugal.
Well, there we are. Then.
Guess who's top of the pops in Portugal then?
Who?
Os Beatles.
Os Beatles.
Ridiculous. Os Beatles. Well, I don't suppose you know the title of your film in Portuguese.
No, Rings de Night.
Could be. Let's hear the number, shall we?
Right.
It's been a hard day's night. And I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do to make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing. And it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why I ventured on home, 'cause when I get you alone, you know I feel alright. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
We did that. We've done that bit.
The train comes in now.
We did that to prove that we weren't playing the record then, you see.
Yeah, we did
because
that.
Otherwise there's no point in your being
like
here,
it,
is there?
No.